Well, hello, and welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast. Join me, Sam Harris, on my journey of curiosity and growth. I have conversations with some of the world's most fascinating humans, from billionaires to Olympians, and most everyone in between, such as suspiciously happy people and even a hitman. Success isn't just for successful people, it is earned and you can earn it too. I find out how ordinary people become extraordinary to fuel your own growth mindset. On the podcast today, we have Karen Stefano, who is the author of the book What a Body Remembers. It's a brilliant book about growth and her story dealing with the effects of sexual assault. It discusses how she learned to deal with the trauma and grow as a person. After her ordeal, Karen went on into the legal profession and she wanted to pursue prosecution, which makes sense. But over time, she actually did the opposite and she became a criminal defense lawyer to protect the accused, which shows some real humility on her side. So she is an amazing person and I think you'll love her message and lessons along the way. So let's get into it.
Thanks for having me, Sam. I'm happy to be on the Growth Mindset Podcast.
Cool. So can you just briefly introduce us to a very short overview of your life?
So I'm a unique person in the sense that I have seen and lived inside the American criminal justice system from literally every angle. When I was a college student at UC Berkeley in Berkeley, California, I worked for the police department and I wore a cop uniform and I patrolled streets and I had the cop radio and I had all of that police training. I was not a full-blown police officer, so I didn't have the gun, but for all intents and purposes, I worked for a law enforcement agency. Then walking home one night after a shift, having changed back into my regular 19-year-old sophomore clothes and with my lavender backpack walking home, I was assaulted at knife point outside my apartment. And my assailant was charged with attempted rape. I was not raped. It was an attempted rape and assault with a deadly weapon. And he was also charged with false imprisonment. So I then saw the criminal justice system from the point of view as a victim and testifying at preliminary hearings against my attacker, testifying at jury trial as the victim. And then I went to law school after college, and my intention was to become a prosecutor and to put away the bad guys. And that's not what happened. I ended up seemingly paradoxically becoming a criminal defense attorney, defending people accused of crime, some as heinous as the one committed against me. And then throw that into the mix, other work experience, working for a federal judge in San Diego in a very busy district with a docket that was mostly criminal cases. And at one point in my life, almost having been charged with a crime myself and going through that process. That's my life story. Part of that is what the book is about. The book is obviously primarily focused on the assault and its aftermath, and then the excavation I did literally 30 years after the assault when the PTSD had come back. And I tracked down my attacker and discovered some life-altering things about him. And that's what the book's about.
Cool. Kind of want to immediately ask what the life-altering things were that you discovered.
Yeah, well, I would tell you, but I would ruin the book for everybody.
What? Okay, fine. So before the attack, you had been planning to go into law though, right?
Yeah, even before the attack, I had planned to go to law school. I was a psychology major as an undergrad, but the plan was definitely to go to law school.
I really enjoyed psychology. So you never wanted to stay in psychology and do kind of those sort of things?
I did initially when I declared the major, and then I got into it and I thought, well, this is really interesting, but is this what I want to do for my career on a day-to-day basis? And do I want to go to medical school so that I can have the psychiatry certification rather than simply the psychologist certification? And I didn't want to go to med school. So.
Okay, sure. So at the time, this was before the Me Too movement and stuff.
Oh, yeah. Long before.
How do you think that sort of relates now to like the context of that? And do you think it's sort of that you like learned a lot of things that could help now with what's been going on, or?
Absolutely. When I started researching and writing this book in 2014, and as I told more and more women what I was writing about, I heard more and more people say, yeah, something like that happened to me too. And those were the words they used. And this was way before the hashtag Me Too movement. But in talking to these women and hearing their stories about what happened to them, I felt that there was a sense of unburdening, if you will, and having them share with me their story. And that sort of reinforced for me that, okay, this is a story that needs to be told. And now, post hashtag Me Too, I believe the story's even more relevant. And what it means to come forward as the quote unquote victim, and what it means to do the personal transformation, which is a very personal process, to transform from victim into survivor, which is a much more empowering word than victim.
Definitely. I mean, how did it feel at the whole time you were doing the prosecution, sort of having to come forward as the victim, like repeatedly?
I had a really awful experience. Times have changed in our criminal justice system. My assault happened in the 80s. Things have definitely improved. But even though I worked for a law enforcement agency, I had a really vague and television informed sense of what happened in the criminal justice system post arrest. And so here I am, this naive 19-year-old girl child, and I get this crash course on the American criminal justice system, a crash course that I didn't have time for. I was still trying to go about my life and study for my classes and get decent grades and still work my law enforcement job so that I could pay my rent. And so it has the potential to be a really traumatic process. And like I say, it's gotten much better, but it could still be improved for anyone participating in the criminal justice system, whether you're a victim, whether you're representing someone who's been charged with a crime. And the thing that can be improved consistently is communication. It's incredibly anxiety-inducing to not know what happens next. And if you're a prosecutor, I feel that you have an obligation to act as an advocate for the victim whose case you are taking to trial, and communicate with that victim. And as a criminal defense lawyer, you obviously have an obligation to communicate with your client and tell them, hey, here's what happens next. You're going to be able to post bail and you're going to get out of jail and then you're going to come back to court and this is what happens. And then there'll be a plea bargain. If we don't like the plea bargain, we go to trial, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But just communication, telling people what to expect next. And in my experience as a victim of a sexual assault, nobody ever communicated with me. The DA was incredibly incommunicative. I was told at the last minute, hey, you need to come testify at jury trial next week. And I was like, I can't do that. I have classes and I'm working my butt off to get my grades up. And their response was, in so many words, tough shit. And so that didn't help the experience for me.
Yeah, that's really annoying. I can imagine it being kind of almost like imposter syndrome or something, where you feel like perhaps everyone's going to think that you're just making it up or something, and then it's just going to be like five times worse. But I don't think.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting that you bring up the phrase imposter syndrome, because one of the things that I experienced post-assault was not giving myself permission to feel the trauma. I pushed everything down, which in retrospect was not a healthy way to deal with the assault. But I kept telling myself, nothing happened. You weren't even hurt and you weren't raped. And so get over it. And had really, really damaging self-talk. And only over the course of years have I realized how damaging that was. And when I've been on tour and talking about this book, people have asked me frequently, what do you tell someone who's experienced a sexual assault? And I tell them, do the opposite of everything that I did. Watch yourself talk. Don't tell yourself, I'm losing my mind, I'm going crazy. Shift your self-talk to something that's more gentle and more loving. And tell yourself, I'm not going crazy. Tell yourself, something horrible happened, and this is going to be really tricky to navigate and uncomfortable, and it's going to take some time, but I will get through this. I will not feel this fear for the rest of my life.
Definitely. What do you think you'd have done if you were sexually assaulted a few years later?
What would I have done differently? Like if I was sexually
assaulted? Yeah, do you think you would have then fallen into like a more sort of post-traumatic kind of, actually, this is my destiny, I'm going to be scared of men forever? Or do you think you would have been actually like, actually, maybe these things happen, but I can be stronger and just move on, I don't need to worry about these things? Like, where do you think your mind would have gone?
That's an interesting question. I guess it would depend upon the circumstances of my assault, were the, you know, man jumps out of the bushes and attacks you at knife point. And many sexual assault survivors' story is being the victim of a sexual assault via someone they know. Mm. And I think that impacts how you process the assault. And I've spoken, obviously, to many sexual assault survivors. And something that's very alarming and interesting to me is the tendency to engage in self-blame, like in a date rape situation, oh, I was drinking, or oh, I didn't fight back enough. And the real issue should be, he shouldn't have done that. You know, stop the self-blame. Mm. And I think that that's part of rape culture in our society. There's a tendency for people to victim blame and to not believe women. That's shifting gears a little bit. That's why the Harvey Weinstein verdict was so heartening. There were no police witnesses. The jurors unanimously believed these women. And based on these women's words only, and I didn't expect it to happen. I was stunned. I was thrilled, but I was joyfully surprised.
Yeah, that was one piece of good news being bad that it happened, but at least justice was actually served.
Yeah, and again, what I always say too, obviously, having been a criminal defense attorney, I believe in due process. I believe in punishments being proportional to crime. And you have the right to cross-examine your accusers, et cetera. But what's so disturbing to me is to see these wealthy, privileged men manipulate the justice system in their favor. And I certainly thought that that's how was going to be the outcome of the Weinstein case. And like I said, I've never been so happy to be wrong in my life.
Yeah. That's good. Yeah, so how do you work out what is proportionally punishing to what the offense was?
It's a case by case basis. And I know that you're in the UK. Mm-hmm. And I assume that the majority of your listeners maybe are in the UK. I don't know.
US, no, definitely.
No, US? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, then I want to throw out the example of Senator Al Franken, who was a former comedian and was shamed into resigning his Senate seat over a silly photograph. And people in the US have since called that political malpractice to this man, this excellent representative, should be called upon to resign his Senate seat for a silly photograph that wasn't even an assault that was taken years and years ago. So that's an example, but I don't think that's proportional.
Yeah, it's weird, as in from like the kind of Buddhist sort of belief or something, like every moment you're like a new person and like you can learn and change instantly if it so happens. So you might never need to actually take any punishment to sort of be a good person that society needs you to be in some ways. But I guess it also prevents other people from wanting to do these things. Well, it sort of makes a demonstration that you shouldn't do it if you see that you can't get away with it, I guess. But it's confusing, especially when it's something from like a long time ago. And I was perfectly a bit of an idiot when I was young anyways. And if I got arrested now for something I did then, it would seem quite wrong if it's something that I just would never do anymore, even though at the time I probably deserved to be punished for it. It's weird.
There's no doubt these are complicated issues that we are going to have to grapple with as a society as we try to change what's known as rape culture, what's okay and what's not okay. And I think we're working on that as a society now, trying to change older generations' beliefs in the quote unquote boys will be boys excuse. And, you know, when your son comes home after losing at lacrosse and saying, oh, I got totally raped, and saying, whoa, that's not cool. You don't talk like that. And not that long ago, these weren't conversations that we were having. And so that's a wonderful thing about the books and stories like mine, is that they're helping us have a greater cultural conversation.
Definitely. So moving on, why did you change your mind from wanting to sort of be someone like putting people away to becoming a criminal defense attorney? Because that seems like a bit of a mind shift change.
Yeah, for sure. And this is something, again, that I address directly in the book. But like most things in this life, it was pure chance. I had clerked in the San Diego District Attorney's Office. And in that jurisdiction, when you serve as a law clerk, you're pretty much guaranteed an offer as a deputy district attorney. But then I had all these student loans to pay. And so I didn't take a position as a deputy district attorney. I took a position with a civil law firm, was miserable immediately, and tried to get the job back with the district attorney's office. This was like in the 90s, and the economy was in the toilet, and there was a hiring freeze, and things just got worse and worse for me. I quit my job at the civil firm because I was so miserable, and then I couldn't pay my rent. And here I am, like this law school graduate, and I had to move back in with my parents, and I felt like such a loser. And I knew some criminal defense lawyers, and they said, hey, you know, make some court appearances for me, ghostwrite my briefs if you just need some money. And I started doing it, and I started interacting with the clients, and I started seeing their humanity, and I started seeing that so many prosecutors see things as black and white. There's the right way and there's the wrong way, and there's no gray areas in between, and there's no forgiveness. And really, it was just meeting the clients. And then I started getting my own clients. Most of the work that I did was public defense work. I was in private practice, but took cases that the public defender's office couldn't handle because they were so overloaded. And so it just built and built. And the reason I stayed on that side was seeing the gray areas, was seeing that people make mistakes. And most of the people who I represented, 99.9% of my clients, were the poorest, least educated, no safety net in sight members of society. And these were people who had no one looking out for them, no one fighting for them. And again, this is something I talk about in the book, but that's how I sort of found my voice. I found my voice advocating for these downtrodden people. There are some gray areas here, and these are human beings, and these are human beings with legal rights. That's one of the things I say in the book, is that we never know where this life is going to take us.
And yeah. When you do the things you think you want to do, you never really open yourself up to the opportunities of the things that are kind of out there. You know what I mean? As in, like, you wouldn't have chosen to do the thing that actually ends up being like a bigger calling for you, perhaps. If you try and read the news that's the opposite to what you think, and you try and talk to people that maybe have different opinions to you, that's where you learn a lot more about, like, why you might be wrong and how the world kind of really works compared to just only ever seeing things in your own view. So some other things that you had to talk about was, how do women sort of more come forward? And cause it's important for them to share their stories, but how do they first go about that process? Because it can be quite hard.
It's a very personal process, and every woman is going to navigate it in her own way. It's well known that many sexual assaults aren't reported, and for a variety of reasons, there are emotional costs in coming forward. And it's pretty interesting that so many victims have been criticized for not coming forward to legal authorities immediately following an assault. And my response to that is, I came forward immediately. I scrambled up from the ground, and as my attacker ran inside my apartment and called 911, he was detained immediately, and he was still acquitted and let go. I underwent a lot of emotional strain and re-trauma for nothing. And so when people say, oh, how can you believe someone who doesn't come forward immediately? My response is sort of snarky, and I came forward seconds later and look where it got me. But that's, again, that's something we're growing as a society in terms of myths. You know, it's a myth that if a woman doesn't come forward immediately, it didn't happen. And we're having these difficult conversations as a culture, and I'm just happy to see that we're having the conversation. But I'll share with you a personal story on that note. My neighbor, who lived down the hall from me, she was in her 70s. And after having read my book, she felt comfortable telling me, and she'd never told anyone, that she was sexually assaulted as a child by one of her mother's boyfriends. That's just a stunning thing. And, you know, we could sit here and talk to her for hours saying, why didn't you ever tell anyone? For her, for any woman, I think the answer is going to be different. It's going to be very personalized. But I was very touched that after having read my book, she felt comfortable enough with me, in spite of our factual circumstances being so different, but that she felt comfortable coming forward and saying something like that happened to me too. And so that's the other important part of sharing our stories, is that we empower others to come forward and share their stories.
Yeah, definitely. It's around the time the meeting movement happened, me and my friend, we've gone to Japan on business, and like our boss's boss had kind of done some things that he really shouldn't have done, and like we'd never really done anything about it since, but then we did have a conversation like, should we do something? And but we figured it was like 5 years later, yeah, maybe we shouldn't bother. but it did make us like think about it again, and like realize that actually that was really weird and you shouldn't have done that. And yeah, I mean, a bit of a non-story that we didn't actually then go and forward, but yeah, we sort of thought about like how we would even do it, which we hadn't even like contemplated as a possibility before, I guess, which maybe if something had been like a bit worse, we'd gone like one step further, then we probably would have.
Yeah, and again, I mean, things are changing, and it's becoming easier for men to intercede and tell other men, stop.
Yeah, it's a hard one. But I think it's, well, hard to know the effects. I don't know if you look at the statistics, if it has sort of had an impact on the amount of men doing these things, or and women. I mean,
yeah,
and I've been abused by women twice as well. More than that, by men.
Men are sexual assault victims. Men are raped. It's not only women, but the vast majority of the victims are women. And it is so hard, too, when so many incidents are unreported.
Definitely. Kind of like the whole issue we have going on with COVID-19 about not having enough testing. We don't really know what's going on, and people need to self-report more and stuff. Much easier to work out what's really going on if we had like the data on everything.
Right.
Lessons. Okay, so I have a few like final questions that I like to ask. What is one of the earliest memories that you have that's like distinct?
I have kind of a combo of memories of being a small child in my family home. Yeah. And my parents being around, my grandmother being around. It is warm, but no one's childhood is perfect. And in a happy childhood, there's always underlying currents. I had a very happy, uneventful childhood. My mother suffered from anxiety issues, and that gets transmitted to a child. And that was definitely transmitted to me. And it's interesting, there's an undercurrent in my book, What a Body Remembers. There's very much an undercurrent of the mother-daughter theme there too. So again, it's interesting that you bring that up.
Yes, it's a strange one. Like, I never really know what's going to happen when I ask that question, but can be really insightful, can be useless. It's like a kind of like almost like gambling or something. You just never know what you're going to get. So, like it. Then what's one of the kindest things that someone's done for you?
Really simple things. I think sharing a smile. Just the other day, obviously we're on COVID-19 lockdown, but we're still allowed to go outside and exercise, and but we're all social distancing. And I was just walking down this path and just had eye contact with a woman, and we shared a smile. I mean, that's happened to me many times. It's something I share in the book. There was a judge at my assailant's preliminary hearing, and I'm there testifying, and I'm terrified. And the female judge, I'll never forget it. I mean, she just sort of looked at me and smiled at me. And it was just like such a simple act of kindness. And maybe it sounds trite, but just sharing a smile and eye contact with another human being, I think, is one of the most intimate and kind things that you can do. But I have to turn it back at you. What's the kindest thing anyone's ever done for you?
I guess when people sort of believe in you before you're ready, kind of thing, as in when you get trusted to do something that you haven't proven that you're capable of, but you become capable by being tested on it, and you grow so much faster, and it really helps build your courage to do things that you didn't think you could do. I think that's one of the best things that people have ever done for me. As in, sometimes it's just like people telling you that you should do something when you didn't think it as well, as in like saying, hey, you'd be really good at this. Didn't think you were. It's the same effect. Yeah. But yeah, I like kindness. It's nice to spread some suggestions for it.
Yes.
Have it in people's brains ready to be like, be more kind in their daily lives. So thank you very much for the interview, and I hope you have a lovely day, and best of luck with them, whatever you're going to do in the rest of your life.
Yes. Well, thank you so much, Sam. I appreciate you having me on the podcast.
Not at all.
Do you experience stress or have anxiety, or maybe chronic pain, or have trouble sleeping at least once a week? Well, you're not alone. Many of us do. Personally, I do go through phases of not sleeping very well and suffer from chronic pain from where I shattered my femur. So I was searching for anything that would help and discovered Feels. What is Feels? It's a premium CBD delivered directly to your door. And what does it do? It naturally helps reduce stress, anxiety, pain, and sleeplessness. So now I kind of sleep a bit better. It's really easy to take. You place a few drops of Feels under your tongue and you feel different within minutes. The thing to remember that it can take a while to find the right dose, and everyone's dose is different, so you could leave some room to experiment over the course of a week. But what's really great is that they have a human support hotline, so you can talk to a real human about your experience and have some guidance. And remember, it's quite natural, so it'll help you feel better without any high or hangover or addictions. They also have a nice membership option, which lets you join a community and get Feels delivered to your doorstep every month, and you can save money on every order and pause your subscription. In summary, Feels has me feeling my best every day, and it can help you too. So you can become a member by going to feels.com/growth, and you'll get 50% off your first order with free shipping. That's F-E-A-L-S, feels.com/growth to become a member and get 50% off automatically from your first order with free shipping. feels.com/growth.
Congratulations on listening to a whole episode of the Growth Mindset Podcast. Before you race into another podcast, try pausing. Ask yourself, what have you learned? What could you change? How will you make that change happen? Did you press pause? Knowledge is useless without action. What did you learn? What should you change? And how will you make that change happen? You can tell us what you learned by contacting us through the website, growthmindsetpodcast.com, and feel free to connect with us or our guests, or just peruse the show notes. Our Instagram is at growthmindsetpodcast, or follow me at samjamsnaps for a daily reminder to stop using Instagram.
If you enjoy random acts of kindness and want to support the show, you can support us on Patreon or leave us a review on iTunes, and you'll make me very happy. And with that, keep learning and keep growing.